Thank you. Have a look at these three faces on the screen. You probably recognise two of them fairly easily. We've got Sarah Ferguson, Duchess of York, on the left. Motty, John Motson, in the middle. If you can recognise a third one, you're doing remarkably well. He's Sali Berisha, the former president of Albania. So if you're not up with Albanian politics, you might have been struggling on that one. But all of these people have one thing in common, and that is their admiration for our guest tonight. Sarah Ferguson said, Bill Hamilton's a man I admire greatly for his dedication to people in need. Bill's former flatmate John Motson says, a forthright and fearless news reporter, Bill's also one of life's most engaging characters. His loyalty, caring nature and sense of humour, a source of great support to all who know him. And Sali Berisha talks of Bill's passion and commitment and says, his reports from Albania prompted governments and thousands of ordinary people to respond at our country's time of greatest need. So, three admirers, and I'm sure you're going to take to him too. Please welcome Bill Hamilton. Thanks, Bill. Well, thank you very much for coming and braving Thames Link all the way from St Albans. Both his trains he had to get were cancelled, but then turned up, which
both of them
turned up, although they weren't supposed to be there, which tells you something about the way Thames Link and the new timetables are going at the moment. For a lot of us, Bill's face and voice will be very familiar from watching BBC News in years gone by. Let me jog your memory with this. Very quiet.
It's Swaziland.
Bill Hamilton, BBC News, Zambia. Bill Hamilton, BBC News, Tirana. Bill Hamilton, BBC News, Zimbabwe. Bill Hamilton, BBC News, Scotland.
There, it comes flooding back now, doesn't it? How long were you with the BBC, Bill?
About 26 years, I think. Started in Scotland, in Glasgow, as a reporter, and then became presenter of the evening news programme up there for the BBC, reporting Scotland. So it was a bit of fun. And then I moved down here. I was on BBC Radio for a little while as a sports producer and reporter. In fact, I used to read the football results just after John Webster, before James Alexander Gorton took over, and he did that for about 37 years.
And did you
get
the intonation right? You know, so right. Hamilton Academicals 2, Falkirk 2, yes. Or
no, Arsenal 2, Tottenham Hotspur 1.
Right.
Arsenal 1, Tottenham Hotspur 2. Arsenal 2, Tottenham Hotspur 2. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, he got it. He's good. Yeah, absolutely. And how many countries do you think you visited during your time with the BBC?
Well, all across Europe except Bulgaria I've been to, most of Africa, most of America, and never been to Australasia. So that's something I've still got to do.
Oh, yeah. Neither have I. Maybe we could have a trip together. Well, let's go back to the beginning. We're jumping the gun there. You were born in Dundee. In Bonnie, Scotland.
City of the Three J's. Do the audience know what the Three J's stand for, I wonder?
I think you better tell them.
The three main industries in Dundee all started with the letter J. Jute. Jam. No, journalism.
So, that's Dundee for you. And you were, I think, from the look of it, he's a very cute baby. There.
Oh, my goodness.
Don't you see,
my mother thought, well, I have an elder brother who's 5 years older than me, and my mother was desperate to have a girl. So I think it probably explains that little curl on the top there. Yeah.
You haven't kept that hairstyle.
I go to a Turkish barber now.
I'm sure he could do if you asked, but tell us about your family.
Well, I had very strict parents, actually, mother and father. My father had been a lieutenant in the Navy during the war, and one of his pupils was actually the Duke of Edinburgh, who at the time was courting Princess Elizabeth, as she was then. And he got himself into serious trouble, my father, for refusing to let Philip off early from lessons to go and meet up with Elizabeth. And then afterwards, he became commander of the Royal Naval Reserve, the electrical commander. So we used to go out in the minesweepers while we were examining his radar treatment. And then we'd eat the roast pork and then get to the leeward side and get rid of everything we'd eaten. that was the first taste of the sea for me. Yeah. And then my father, he became a fire loss assessor. And nowadays, I think most of the insurance companies, they send their own people to assess any damage, you know, at a fire and so on. But in these days, it was thought that it was good to have a neutral. So a neutral person would come in, assess the sort of damage, sent in what they thought was a fair bill to the insurance company, and most of the time that was paid out. So that was my father's job there.
But you said they were strict, your parents?
Very strict, yes. I remember if we wanted to comb our hair, we had to go out to the coal cellar outside in case any dandruff fell on the floor. But they were very sacrificial parents, and we lived in a council house to start with, and they saved up every penny to send my brother and I to a fee-paying school. And I'm not so sure that, you know, I may have repaid them as well as I should with my education. You see, when I went to school, I thought all the teachers loved me because my notebooks were full of red kisses. It's only when I got home and got a clip over the ear from my father that I discovered that these distinctive little marks meant something quite different. And particularly when the headmaster had written on my report card, "Bill sets very low standards for himself and continually fails to maintain them."
Oh, that's quite damning.
Was really, yes.
But as you went through school, you sort of basically got along okay, and you managed to keep up to pass your exams as necessary?
Reasonably so, yes. I got my hires at the end of the day, but I was very interested in going into the church, actually, but my results were not high enough to get into a theology college, and that's why I turned to journalism, really.
Mm. So you're a church-going family?
We were. My father was an elder in the Church of Scotland, and I was a very enthusiastic member of the Boys' Brigade. And I felt that that helped shape my life, the discipline, the responsibility that we had, sport we used to play together, gymnastics, drill parades, etc. All that I said in their motto, really, that leads towards a true Christian manliness. That's what they were trying to do with us. And, you know, I found it a very nice way of life. And we spent all our weekends there, drill parade Friday night. We had a big club on a Saturday night, and we had huge model railway. And in fact, at Christmas time, all the department stores in Dundee used to compete as to who would get our railway to go in there. So that was a great way of spending Christmas there. And Sunday morning, it was Bible class. And that was quite important. And you know, the great theologian William Barclay wrote all the textbooks, really, for the Bible class, for the little sermons for the boys, and it was all written in language that they could understand. But our captain, Walter Brown, was a great individual, lived his whole life for the welfare of the boys, really. And his sermons were so simple, but so meaningful. For instance, he talked about swearing. What need was there for swearing? If a guy's a fool, he's a fool anyway. So whatever adjective you put in front of it won't change that subject. I never thought about it that way before, but it was a very good example, really, in my younger years.
Great. And then you did, as you say, move on into journalism. Why journalism? Was it because it was one of the only three things you were allowed to do in Dundee, or what?
Well, no, the other thing was I was a great football fan, and my father had taken me to see Dundee play in the early 1950s.
I think we jumped the gun with the picture.
Oh, right.
Sorry, carry on. Yes, right. Carry on, yeah.
I used to come home and I wrote my own little sports paper and contained the report, my report on the match I'd just seen. And you remember in those days that all the cigarette packets used to have pictures, cards of all the players. And I used to save those up. So if one of those players was in my match, I was able to stick that on the front page too. And the competition really was to get that paper into my father's hands before the Dundee Sporting Post came through the letterbox about 7 o'clock. So it was quite an exercise.
So what were your first jobs as a professional journalist?
Well, you had to do everything. I started on a weekly paper, and I was the highest paid junior that paper had ever employed, £5.10 a week for what was normally a 6-day week. Now, I parked my car not so long ago in one of these NCP car parks, you know, up in the West End, admittedly for most of the day. But the barrier didn't lift until I'd parted with the princely sum of £26. I thought to myself, you know, that was a month's wages back in 1960. Incredible. No, I used to enjoy covering the little town councils. I can still remember all the names: Cooper, Ladybank, Falkland, Newborough, Auchtermuchty. These were great powerhouses of decision making, where the councillors would spend half an hour debating the merits of deploying a 100-watt clear or Perro light bulb in the ladies' loo. And then Edward Heath came along in the 1970s and abolished all the small town councils in Scotland. And I think that was a great shame, because there was a lot of civic pride in these places. And to me, it was sacrificing this little layer of democracy on the altar of greater bureaucracy. So if you want to see the ermine, chains of office, drums, hats, etc., you now have to go to the local museum. Mm-hmm.
But it was useful training for your further career?
Very useful. And because apart from doing councils, of course, you had to do the court cases, you had to do agriculture, you had to do sport. It was a combination of everything. So, and you had to do lineage, as they called it, for the daily papers. If there was a story in your area, you would do a small summary of it and then phone it over to the Daily Express or the Mail or the Guardian or whatever. And you got a little bit extra wage for that.
Yeah. And did you take to it straight away? Was it something you thought, this is really what I want to do?
From the moment I went through the door, you know, the lovely smell of the books and everything in the thing, and to see these great... In those days, of course, everything was set on hot metal presses, you know, linotype machines. The slugs used to come off at 200 degrees. The page
slugs?
Was, yeah, little metal slugs.
Right, okay.
Then they went to the stone where the page was made up, and then the pages went to the foundry where the steel plates were created, and then they would be lowered down ever so gently to the great dinosaur of a printing machine in the basement. So it was quite an exercise, and they used to... The printers used to say that working in the stone was purgatory, and because it was just so hot and uncomfortable. Nowadays, of course, everything is, well, all these people are their own printers nowadays. They do it all at home, set it all on your computers at home, and it's exactly the same with the papers. Yeah.
But by the age of 22, you were in television. How did that come about?
Yes, that was very lucky. And if I remember rightly, you'll remember Henry Cooper fought Cassius Clay, and remember he put him down, but Clay recovered and the fight was stopped after Cooper got a cut over his eye. Well, he had a rematch back in 1966. That one isn't remembered so much. But it was being shown in the cinemas, and I was at the cinema in Newcastle, and I bumped into this chap who had been the chief sub in the Shields Gazette, and he suggested that a life in television was great, and I said, oh, I'd love to do that. And he said, well, they're having auditions next Tuesday, so get yourself here. But when I turned up on the Tuesday, my name wasn't on any list. Nobody had heard about me. And I thought all my hopes and dreams were going to be crushed. But then I was sent up to the makeup department where I was told I'd be seen to. I wasn't quite sure what that meant. But all this stuff was put on my face. And when the makeup artist heard what I was here for, you know, she gave me a lot of good advice. And then I made my way through all these rabbit warrens at Tyne Tees Television and ended up in this room with six other candidates. And the news editor was an ex-army officer, Neville Jackson, and he was a bit disturbed to be having his introductory remarks interrupted by this little minion coming into the room. But I was very lucky because, of course, I was the last to be called, and I'd heard what had happened to all the other ones, and was able to join his battle troops. And at the end of the day, I finished up with a job, which to this day I still can't believe. But when I went, when I had to do my first live report on the 6 o'clock news, I remember I had to sit there for 20 minutes waiting to start, and I thought I was going to be physically sick. You know, I was totally terrified. Surprisingly, I've never seen anyone be physically sick reading the news on television. I don't know if you have. But I said to the head newsreader, Bob Langley, I said, you know, what's the audience for this show tonight? He said, oh, about 1.5 million, which is exactly what you want to hear, you know, when you're a bag of nerves. But, you know, the audience for the 10 o'clock news on the BBC tonight will range somewhere between 4.5 and 5 million people. But it's doubtful that anywhere across this country tonight will there be a group of people as big as this watching the news in any one place. You see, it's a representative in a hotel room, a few blokes down in the pub, family at home, a couple of ladies in a care room, a care home. So it's all made up of ones and twos. So Bob said to me, the secret is easy, Bill. Get your shoulders up, take a few deep breaths, and look straight into that camera lens, and I want you to imagine the most beautiful girl in the world, and you will speak to her and her alone. Well, I did, but to this day, I can't understand how I got Sophia Loren so interested in the affairs of Middlesbrough Barakat.
And then there was your big break going out on location for the famed Sunderland chip shop robbery.
Oh, yes. Well, for the first few weeks, of course, when I was there, they didn't trust me enough to send me out on the road. But everybody disappeared for lunch this particular day because I think roast lamb was on the menu, amongst other things. And I was left to man the newsroom. And I was told that anything of any great importance happened to phone the canteen straight away to get somebody on the road. Well, they'd no sooner disappeared when the phone rang, and a chap said there'd been a huge raid, gun raid, on a fish and chip shop in Sunderland. And I said to him, well, we'll check this out. If you're right, you know, we'll send you a little check in the post. So I ran to the canteen and said, I'm on my way to Sunderland. Who's coming down with me, crew? And we got a film crew, got down there. And what had happened was this chap had burst into the fish and chip shop, held a gun to the head of the lady behind the counter and asked her to hand over the money. But she was very brave. What she did was she put the basket into the hot fat, took it out, and poured the hot fat over this chap who was down the road as fast as he could go. But it was at the time that a chap called Harry Roberts, a member who killed three policemen in Shepherd's Bush, was on the run. And there had been reports that a car, you know, bearing somebody with a similar description had been seen in County Durham. So this made it an even bigger story that he might have been coming in to get some money for the road. But anyway, I waited and waited there as the film crew were going to come behind me. But they never seemed to arrive. And then suddenly they came in. I said, they said, who are you? I said, Bill Hamilton, I'm the new boy on the block. Let's go, let's get this interview done. And they said, oh, no, it's a chap called Harold Williamson doing it today. I said, no, it's me. So we did a whole interview when this said Harold Williamson walked into the shop. And he said, what are you doing with my crew? And I didn't realise I was from Tyne Tees and I was using the BBC crew. But they were very good. They gave me the interview anyway.
Now, so at this stage, it was just the northeastern viewers who had the benefits of your handsome good looks and dulcet tones. Yeah. But soon, we were all able to avail ourselves of those on BBC News. Here's a reminder.
In a split second in the early hours of Friday, October the 12th, 1984, the IRA have achieved their most daring strike on the British mainland. Everywhere there is confusion, panic, appalling suffering.
As Bill Hamilton now reports, the city of Tyre has been devastated.
The mayor of Tyre says he wished the Israelis had dropped leaflets urging the PLO to surrender before they came in and bombed the city. But an Israeli officer told him if they'd done that, the city could not have been captured. In the event, it took the Israelis 3 days before they could establish firm control.
This is all that remains of a maternity clinic. A newly born baby and three relatives were all killed when it took a direct hit from an Israeli bomb. The situation in the city's three hospitals is chaotic. There simply isn't enough room for all the injured. By dawn, the full extent of the damage had become clear. One of Toxteth's busiest shopping streets resembled a wartime scene. Dozens of shops had been looted, burned, and then totally destroyed. Those living in upper story flats were homeless. The damage to property had run into millions of pounds. Firemen were doing what they could, but it was a hopeless task.
So what posts did you hold at the BBC? I know you were a home affairs correspondent at one stage. What other jobs did you have with...
Well, I came down as a general reporter when I started. I was very fortunate to get that job because in 1979, the editor of Television News in London thought it would be a good idea if a reporter from each of the English regions, plus the national regions of Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, were to come down to London one at a time for a 1 month's attachment. I mean, that way they would get more experience of doing national news stories. And of course, London would be able to find out where the best talent in the regions lay. And I was the first to be called. And that particular month, I thought, was very, very unlucky because there was just nothing of great national import happening. And then on the second last day of my attachment, Sonny Jim Callaghan lost a vote of confidence in the House of Commons by one vote and was forced to call a general election. Well, of course, the whole newsroom lights up now, people running 101 directions, you know, phones going off all over the place. I'm rubbing my hands with glee, bound to get a good story now. No. The editor said to me, you're going back to Scotland tomorrow. So I said, yes, end of attachment. He said, well, what I want you to do is a feature for BBC Two News for tomorrow, my last day, on the record number of cabinet and ex-cabinet ministers retiring at this election. I thought that I'll never make the break of day. However, I looked up who's who, and I discovered that Michael Stewart, the Foreign Secretary, and George Strauss, the father of the house, shared chess as a pastime. So I set up this little chess match the Hole in the Wall studio, they called it, at College Green opposite the House of Commons. But I also wanted to interview Charles Morgan Giles, who was the Conservative MP for Winchester, had been captain of HMS Belfast and HMS Vernon, and other warships, and he was leaving the House of Commons to go back to the Royal Navy, a very unexpected and very unusual occurrence. So I said to the editor, you don't want the piece until tomorrow. My last day, I'll film the chess match this afternoon and go down to Portsmouth overnight and film Morgan Giles with the whole of the Atlantic fleet behind him in Portsmouth Harbour. Oh, no, he said, no, we're not spending that sort of money. No, don't be silly. Take him over Westminster Bridge. There's lots of boats going up and down in the river. Well, I'm going to be on the sleeper back to Glasgow in a few hours' time, and I'm totally disconsolate as I drive into College Yard, park my car, waiting for Morgan Giles coming out of the double doors. And he's running about 10 minutes late, apologises profusely, gets into the car. I'm not in a very good mood. I said, let's go and get this interview done. But we just started to set off when Éireann Éibh, blown up by the Irish National Liberation Army. Mm-hmm. Now, John, they say it's an ill wind that doesn't blow someone some good. Mm. And here I am, just yards from the blast, nearer than the back of the church here, there before the ambulance, the police, the fire brigade, before they can evacuate the House of Commons. And of course, my story now leads the 6 o'clock news, the weekend bulletins, etc. And the next job that was London was mine. But still today, I mean, I've still got a conscience that my career should have advanced at the expense of the life of the first officer to have escaped from Colditz and the man who was a personal confidant of Margaret Thatcher. Mm. In fact, the one who persuaded him to stand for the leadership of the Conservative Party. So that's how I got the job in London. Mm.
But you must have seen on that occasion, and as you've travelled the world and in this country, you must have been reporting on stories of disasters and tragedies,
yes,
for various people. And you're flitting in and out and doing a story, and they've got to live with that tragedy for the rest of their lives. Did that ever make you feel uneasy or queasy about what you were doing?
No, I never felt guilty about that. You're quite right. A news reporter really is like a fireman in a race to get to the scene of the story and get the story in the pictures as quickly as possible, and nowadays get as fast as you can to the nearest satellite point to get it back for the next story of the day. But no, you're really there to get the story and the pictures where most people sitting at home, they're not going to be there, they can't be there. So you're actually showing them how bad things are. You're testing, I suppose, to a certain extent, their different emotions. But you can be used too as a catalyst to inspire them to do something about it, you know, to get them interested in the story. And you find with charities, if they go for an appeal, almost immediately something is on the news, then they'll get a good response. The problem is that some of them, they have to go back and wait for the board of directors or committees to meet a fortnight later. And by then, that story's disappeared from the headlines and has been replaced by some tragedy somewhere else. So, I saw myself more as a, you know, we must never be the story ourselves. You know, we are the communicators, basically. We convey the story to other people. And the hope is that they'll respond to that and go in and help that situation.
But another thing with your job, you are forever just at the mercy of a phone call saying, this has happened in such and such a place, get there as quick as you can. What effect did that have on your home life?
A journalist's life, there's no respecter of family life, yeah. I can remember I'd been on duty for about 3 weeks. You're supposed to have days off, but sometimes it doesn't happen because if you're on a story, you normally have to see that story through to the end. But I'd got this Sunday off, and we arranged a picnic with my wife and my two children. We were going out to the Grand Union Canal, and I just got to the car when I could hear the phone ringing in the house. We didn't have mobile phones in those days. And I thought, will I answer that or not? And my wife's sister wasn't very well, so we thought it could be her. So I came into the house, picked up the phone, and a few rather strong expletives came down the other end of the phone from the news editor saying, where have you been? I said, well, I haven't been anywhere yet. I'm just on my way to the Grand Union Canal. And he said, oh, no, you're not. You're on your way to Lebanon. The Israelis have just invaded, and you're going with them. Now, I'd never been to the Middle East before, and that was quite a frightening sort of experience. So they said, pack your bags for a week or so, because you could be there for a little bit of time. Well, I think it was about 2 months before I got back from there. So you can notice your children actually have grown two or three more inches in
that.
And
that must have happened on several occasions.
Yes.
We need to move on to another part of your life, and that's been refereeing. As BBC's Football Focus reminded us.
Former BBC correspondent Bill Hamilton has been honoured by the FA in recognition of the 50 years he served as a referee. So the perfect man, we thought, to ask whether the game is changing for the better.
Bill Hamilton visited the city of Shkodra.
The IRA have achieved their most daring strike.
As a BBC correspondent, I was very lucky. I used to travel the world. And I always brought a whistle with me in my pocket. And there was a spare minute anywhere, and I saw boys out on the track, you know, just to roll a football out, and off we went. In 1957, Santa Claus put the FA book for boys into my stocking. And there was an article there that said that even in your teens, you could make the greatest contribution to the game as a referee. I started at 14. I was having to marshal players twice or in some instances three times my age. One of the first games I ever did was a Scottish Schoolboys Cup semi-final between Dundee and Edinburgh. Dundee won 7-3, and a young man playing centre-forward called Peter Lorimer, who was to become a Leeds legend, scored 5 goals that night. One of those, I used to think, I wonder why referees are the last people in sport to attract sponsorship. I mean, I would have thought that we would have had an optician or two since we're all blind, an orphanage or two, seeing our parentage is called into question every weekend.
What's that for it?
Clenched fist into the back.
Or maybe even a funeral undertaker or two, because most of us wear black.
He's not holding the flag for nothing, please.
But without the referee, you're not going to have any match.
What happens on a Saturday night or match of the day, everybody at grassroots sees that. And you can see it being repeated out here on a Saturday.
Go! Oh, no! No! Let's go!
The FA have got to take a much more severe line. The punishments have to be so hard that players who do start diving and so on, the suspensions have got to be for such a period, and the clubs will suffer because their star players are not playing, that they're not going to repeat it.
Are you stopping refereeing soon, or are you going to carry on for as long as you're able?
I think that's a red card question, don't you? Well done. Cheers. Well done. Well done. I still think there's a little bit life left in the legs yet, but we'll see. But that's 2,029 games now. I go home today, which is a lot of games. And at an average of 5 miles a game running, that's 10,000 miles. So I've reached Peru and beyond. But at my age, the big question is, how the Blazers do I get back again?
Excellent. And I have here, don't know if you can see this, the actual award he got. Here it is. You can come and inspect it yourselves later. FA award for 50 years service. You're saying it mostly goes to sort of administrators and people like that. It's
what they call the Blazers. Actually, it's got up to 60 years now.
60 years.
Oh, dear me.
Is it possibly any connection you can see between journalism and refereeing?
Oh, yes. Scrupulous impartiality.
Excellent. Good. And how did you manage to fit it in with your work commitments?
Difficult, but... when you were at the BBC, obviously, if you were away on an assignment for 4 or 5 weeks, you couldn't be available on a Saturday or a Tuesday night. Today, even to referee in the Southern League or the Football League and so on, you have to be able to give up every Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Saturday, etc. And the pressures on these people today are very great. So you can't have everything in life. I started young enough, and if they had thought I'd had the ability, I don't know whether they did or not, I certainly got my class 1 by the 1960s, late 1960s, and got on to the North Eastern League, which was Blyth Spartans, Bishop Auckland, etc., quite a good standard of football. And I was on my way to the Football League, but when I got a job with the BBC, that was an impossibility. So you can't have everything in life, you know.
But you say you're still doing it at 74.
Yes, well, I'm more as an assistant referee now, as they call it, as a linesman. But I am refereeing at the Dana Cup, which is one of the biggest international youth tournaments in the world, next month out in Denmark. So we're enjoying that.
You joke in the film there about people being questioning your parentage, as you put it politely. But it can't be fun being constantly abused. We have a nephew who took up refereeing at university, and he refereed games, university level games, for a couple of years. But after a bit he thought, I don't have to be abused like this every week.
And I'm afraid,
and he gave up.
Yes, I'm afraid there's a lot of people, young, very promising referees, are leaving for that very reason. Yes, sometimes you wished you had double glazing in your car when you're driving away from some of the grounds, such as the abuse. But down here, most things tend to be forgotten in the conviviality of the social club after the game. Can't remember it being like that in one club in Aberdeen that I visited. When you went into the bar after the game, as a referee, you were basically treated as a social outcast, yeah? The only thing you could befriend was the one-armed bandit in the corner. Now, John, I don't know if you've ever played a one-armed bandit in Aberdeen, but even if you get a line of three cherries, it doesn't pay any money out, just an IOU note.
Very good. Have you been watching the World Cup?
I have indeed, yes. And I'm told we're not to give today's scores out because at least there's one gentleman in the audience has set his camera, machine to see it later on.
Yes, so you're missing Brazil's game by being here. We're very grateful. But who will you be supporting?
Well, surprisingly for a Scot who's lived down here for 38 years now, my sympathies do lie to a certain extent with England, and I'd like them to progress a little bit further this time round. Got a very young squad. I don't think anybody's holding out high hopes for them, but even if they got as far as the quarterfinals, I think they'd be doing quite well.
For those of you who hate football, don't worry. I mean, the World Cup's only with us for another 4 weeks. So it's just, the final's 4 weeks today. But you can just talk amongst yourselves for a moment, because I've got another question to do with football. What do you think about VAR, Video Assistant Referee?
Interesting, because as a journalist and as a referee, the one thing you want to get right are your facts. You want to get everything correct. But I think it'll be interesting to see, because it's on trial, really, during this World Cup. And I think it'll be interesting to see how it all finishes up at the end of the day. It's been used two or three times already in the first couple of games. But I'm very worried about VAR because the Premier League in particular in this country is seen by billions of people now, an audience of billions across the world. Why do they watch it? They watch it because of the excitement, the skill, and the intensity of the game. And I'm not sure that VAR isn't going to interrupt that. This idea of having a stoppage, you know, instead of cheering for your goal, you've got to wait another 30 seconds to see whether you're going to get it or not. There's one thing about getting decisions right, but in a way, arguments and everything else kind of make football, and the football fraternity quite enjoy that, discussing all the implements of the game. So it'll be interesting to see how it finishes up, and I think this will be the real trial. The Premier League said they're not going to have it next season, but maybe the year after. But I think this will be the deciding time, the next 4 weeks.
And it was football that really led to your biggest ongoing story, all your films from Albania, but we're going to talk about that later, because now we're going to have a 10-minute interval, chance for you to get some drinks and snacks, and back here in 10, please. Okay.